Good evening. I'd like to welcome everyone here this evening. Tonight I'm going to be studying from the book of Esther. This takes place about 450 to 500 years before Christ. This is shortly after some of the Jews have returned back to Jerusalem from Babylonian captivity, but yet some of them are still in captivity and living scattered throughout the world. And so this is during the reign of Ahasuerus, or some people would think is Xerxes. And so this is kind of gets us in a time frame of when this takes place. And so I want to begin reading in Esther, the second chapter, beginning in verse 21. And so it says, in those days, while Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate, Bigtham and Terash, two of the king's officials from those who guarded the door, became angry and sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. But the plot became known to Mordecai, and he told Queen Esther, and Esther informed the king of Mordecai's name. Now when the plot was investigated and found to be so, they were both hanged on a gallows, and it was written in the book of the Chronicles in the king's presence. So I read that because that's going to be a key part of the story later on. So now I want to turn, Esther is Mordecai's niece, and he has taken her in and raised her as his daughter. So that's the relationship between Mordecai and Esther. And I'm probably going to call Mordecai Haman and Haman Mordecai after a while, so just kind of get used to that because I will get names confused. And so now I want to go ahead and read the first three verses of chapter 3. It says, after these events, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman, the son of Hammedatha the Agite, and advanced him and established his authority over all the princes who were with him. All the king's servants who were at the king's gate bowed down and paid homage to Haman, for so the king had commanded concerning him, but Mordecai neither bowed down nor paid homage. Then the king's servants who were at the king's gate said to Mordecai, Why are you transgressing the king's command? Now it was when they had spoken daily to him, he would not listen to them. They told Haman to see whether Mordecai's reason would stand, for he had told them that he was a Jew. So here we have Mordecai, who is a Jew, and he refuses to bow down to Haman, who is second in command there in Susa in Persia. And so it doesn't tell us exactly why Mordecai won't bow down to him. There are some people that, through some historical research, think that maybe he had some type of an idol that was embroidered somehow on his clothes, or maybe it was because of he knew what kind of man Haman was. But anyway, he won't bow down to him, and so we see that this infuriates Haman. He's filled with rage because he won't bow down to him, and he found out he's doing it because he says he's a Jew. And so he gets angry at all the Jews. And so if we go on and look at verses 8, it says, then Haman said to King Ahasuerus, there is a certain people scattered and dispersed among all the peoples in all the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from those of all other people, and they do not observe the king's laws. So it is not in the king's interest to let them remain. If it is pleasing to the king, let it be decreed that they be destroyed, and I will pay 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those who carry on the king's business to put into the king's treasuries. Then the king took his signet ring from his hand and gave it to Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agite, the enemy of the Jews. And so Haman goes to the king, and he doesn't tell what nation of people, what group of people. He just says there's a certain group of people living in our land, and they don't obey our laws, and he wants to put them to death. And it seems like very hastily Ahasuerus gives him this authority. And also, I should have stated earlier, Esther is also a Jew who is the queen at this time, but she has withheld her national origin that she's a Jew. And so he's basically, Haman has deceived the king by not telling him, first of all, who he wants to destroy it, but just tell them that there's a certain group of people. And so all these letters are sent throughout the land, all of Persia. And so you can imagine if you're a Jew and you get this letter, and the letter states that on this certain day, March the 14th, all the Jews are going to come and they're going to destroy you and kill you and carry off all your property, your wife and your kids. So that would be a very distressful proclamation or a letter to get in the mail, wouldn't it? I mean, I get mad when the IRS sends me something that I was off 25 cents. Now, if I get the one that says they're coming to kill me, then I'm really going to be upset. And so we see that Mordecai, here in chapter 4, when Mordecai learned all that had been done, he tore his clothes and put on sackcloth and ashes and went out into the midst of the city and wailed loudly and bitterly. He went as far as the king's gate, for no one was able to enter the king's gate, clothed in sackcloth. In each and every province where the command and decree of the king came, there was great mourning among the Jews, with fasting, weeping, and wailing, and many lay on sackcloth and ashes. Then Esther's maidens and her eunuchs came and told her, and the queen writhed in great anguish, and she sent garments to clothe Mordecai, that he might remove his sackcloth from him, but he did not accept him. So here we see that Esther finds out about it. She sees Mordecai, hears about him out in the, outside the courtyard, and she sends out clothes. And then in verse 8, we see that Mordecai says he also gave a copy of the text of the edict, which had been issued in Susa for their destruction, that he might show Esther and inform her and to order her to go into the king to implore his favor and to plead with him for her people. Now, that would seem like a simple thing. Here she is, the queen, and she could go in and implore that he not kill all the Jews, which would also include her. But we see it's not quite that simple. Here in verse 11, it says, All the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces know that for any man or woman who comes to the king's inner court who is not summoned, he has but one law, and that he be put to death unless the king holds out him the golden scepter so that he may live. And I have not been summoned to him to come to him for these 30 days. So she reminds Mordecai, say, hey, this is the law. If I go into him and stand in the courtyard wanting to come into him, if he doesn't hold out his golden scepter, then I'm going to be put to death. And he hasn't even called for me for 30 days. And so she reminds him, hey, this isn't just me going in and talking to him. This is going to involve a great deal of risk. And she reminds him that she hasn't been invited for 30 days. And then in verse 13, it says, then Mordecai told them to reply to Esther, do not imagine that you in the king's palace can escape any more than all the Jews. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place, and you and your father's house will perish. And who knows whether you have not attained royalty for such a time as this. So he reminds her. He says, look, you're not going to escape this either. Once it's revealed that you're of Jewish heritage, you are also going to be caught up in this. And then he tells her that, so he, first of all, he reminds her that she's not going to escape from this from either. And then he tells her that at this time, relief and deliverance will arise from the Jews from another place. Now, Mordecai is in a situation where he is going to be put to death soon, and he sees that Esther is in a situation where she has maybe some influence. But he says, if you don't do it, relief is going to come from somewhere else. And I think that's the idea that Mordecai realized that God was going to protect his people. Whether Esther did it or somebody else did it, God was going to deliver his people. And we see that God, his plan and his what he wants is going to succeed whether we want to participate in that or not. And we see that throughout the Bible. Whenever God has a plan for somebody and they fall away from him, God finds somebody else to carry out that plan, doesn't he? If you look at the children of Israel, when he brought the children of Israel out of Egypt, they murmured and they sinned, they rebelled against God. What did he do? He waited, right? And he raised up a new generation. So we see that God is going to deliver his people, and he's going to be patient. If the children of Israel weren't willing to do it, he just waited and he brought up the new generation. The same with Esther. Mordecai realizes if Esther doesn't do it, somebody else is going to do it, and that's going to be, you know, basically that's going to be bad for Esther and her family, because he says, and who knows, then he tells her, anyway, he tells her that it would be bad for her family. And so there's some other examples I want to look at. In 1 Samuel, the 9th chapter, in verse 15, we see that God has chosen, Israel wanted a king, and God has chosen for them a king. And he says, Now a day before Saul's coming, the Lord had revealed this to Samuel, saying, about this time tomorrow, I will send you a man from the land of Benjamin, and you shall anoint him to be prince over my people Israel, and he will deliver my people from the hand of the Philistines, for I have regarded my people because their cry has come to me. So here we see God has selected Saul to lead his people. And then if you continue on in chapter 13 of 1 Samuel, we see that Saul fails and he doesn't follow God and doesn't do what God commanded him to do. In 1 Samuel 13 and verse 13, it says, Samuel, this is after Saul has disobeyed God. He says, Samuel said to Saul, you have acted foolishly. You have not kept the commandment of the Lord your God, which he commanded you, for now the Lord would have established your kingdom over Israel forever. But now your kingdom shall not endure. The Lord has sought out for himself a man after his own heart, and the Lord has appointed him as ruler over his people, because you have not kept what the Lord commanded you. God tells Saul that if he would have kept his commandments, he would establish Saul's kingdom forever. We see that Saul disobeyed God and didn't follow God, and he tells him he's going to bring somebody else. And that person is, as we know, that person is David. If we look at 2 Samuel, the 7th chapter, beginning in verse 12, this is God speaking to David through Nathan the prophet. And he says, when your days are complete and you lie down with your fathers, I will raise up your descendants after you, who will come forth from you, and I will establish his kingdom. He shall build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. I will be a father to him, and he will be a son to me. When he commits iniquity, I will correct him with a rod of men and strokes of the sons of men. But my loving kindness shall not depart from him, as I took it away from Saul, whom I removed before you. Your house and your kingdom shall endure forever, shall endure before me forever. Your throne shall be established forever. So here we see that Saul didn't follow God, and so God had found David to get the job done that Saul was not willing to do because he wouldn't follow God. All right, also back over in Esther, one of the things here that I'm not exactly sure how to interpret. I think it could be both ways. In verse 14, it says, for if you remain silent this time, deliverance will arise for you from another place, and you know your father's house will perish. And who knows whether you have not attained royalty for such a time as this. Now, I don't know if Mordecai is trying to tell her that he believes that for sure that she's been put in this place for this time, or if he's saying, you know, we don't know. If God has put you here, for this purpose or not. I can't say one way or the other which one it is, but I think we can look at the Bible as that God put certain people in situations, and we sometimes, he put people in situations, and I don't think that they knew that God had put them in that situation. If you look at Joseph, do you think whenever Joseph was sold into slavery and he was being carried off by the Ishmaelites, he said, this is God's providence plan for me. Is that what he was thinking? Later on in his life, he realized. He said, you meant it for harm, but God meant it for good. So I don't know that, in the Old Testament, people didn't necessarily know whenever God was using them in their plan. But the important thing is that they were following God and being obedient to his commandments. Because we see that whenever God was using Joseph, he was obedient, wasn't he? I mean, the things that he did, whenever he was there in Potiphar's house and when he was in the jail, all those things he did, he was doing that with faith in God. And so God continued to use him in his plan to bring Christ to us. But we see with Saul, Saul was disobedient. God quit. God didn't use Saul. He took that away from him. And so I think that it's interesting that, they don't know. You look at that. Do you think David knew what he was doing whenever he went down to fight Goliath? Do you think Daniel knew when he was being carried off into Babylonian captivity that he was going to be a big part of God's plan? And do you think Mordecai knew that he was going to be a part of God's plan whenever he heard the two guys just talking about killing the king? He did what was right. He went and told the king. So I think that the point of this is, if God's going to put us in a situation where we need to influence somebody, or he wants us to lead somebody to Christ, and we're not being obedient, he's not going to use us, right? He can't. Because we can't lead others to Christ if we're not following Christ. Because you can't find churches that are filled with people that said, I want to be a part of that because I saw that guy going to church, but on Saturday night he was doing this. Churches are not filled with those kind of people. They're filled with the kind of people that said, I was looking for something, and I found this guy, and I could see he was trying to follow the Lord. And so I think that's the point that I want to make from that. Also, if we look at verses 15 and 17, it says, then Esther told them to reply to Mordecai, go assemble all the Jews who are found in Susa and fast for me, and do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my maidens will also fast in the same way. And thus I will go into the king, which is not according to the law. And if I perish, I perish. So Mordecai went away and did just as Esther had commanded him. Two things you see about Esther there. One is she requested fasting. And fasting is almost always accompanied with prayer. Petitioning God, isn't it? So here she was saying, we're going to petition God, and then I'm going to go in, and the point of if I perish, I perish. Or if I die, I die. And so we see her great faith and her willingness to go ahead and take that risk. Then look at chapter 5, the first 8 verses of that. Now it came about on the third day that Esther put on her royal robes and stood in the inner court of the king's palace in front of the king's rooms. And the king was sitting on his royal throne in the royal throne room opposite the entrance to the palace. When the king saw Esther, the queen, standing in the court, she obtained favor in his sight, and the king extended to Esther the golden scepter which was in his hand. So Esther came near and touched the top of the scepter. The king said to her, what is troubling you, Queen Esther? And what is your request, even to half of the kingdom? It shall be given you. Esther said, if it pleases the king, may the king and Haman come to this day to the banquet that I have prepared for him. Then the king said, bring Haman quickly that we may do as Esther desires. So the king and Haman came to the banquet which Esther had prepared. So here we see, when she goes into the king, she's scared, right? And he extends to her the royal scepter, and she comes in and touches it. And he knows He knows that she's there if she wants something, right? Because you just don't take that chance just to come and say, hey, I just wanted to see how you were doing today. Have you heard? You know, he knows she's there for a specific reason. And I think that she goes in, and another thing she doesn't do is she doesn't go in and say, what are you doing? You've signed this decree to kill all the Jews? Does she go in with that, you know, with an attitude of indignation towards him? She kind of goes in there with a plan. And I think as Christians, sometimes whenever we talk to people, that we sometimes don't have a good plan about what we're going to say, and we say the wrong things. And I know you've heard, you know, if somebody's trying to convince someone to become a Christian, you know, maybe they're harsh on them, they condemn them instead of trying to be patient and teaching them. And if you go and you look at, you know, like verses in Colossians, it talks about our, you know, well, let's just turn to Colossians, the fourth chapter. Colossians 4, verse 2. It says, devote yourselves to prayer, keeping alert in it with an attitude of thanksgiving, praying at the same time for us as well, that God will open a door for us for the word so that we may speak forth the mystery of Christ, for which I have also been in prison, that I may make it clear in those that the way we ought to speak, to conduct yourselves with wisdom towards outsiders, making most of the opportunity. So it says, whenever we're to pray for the open door, but when we do that, we conduct ourselves with wisdom. And I think that Esther here, she conducted herself with wisdom in the way that she approached Ahasuerus. And so we need to, as Christians, we need to learn how to use wisdom whenever we're trying to teach somebody. You know, as Christians, we're often required to rebuke someone who is sinning and doing wrong. We have got to do that with wisdom so that we draw them in. We've got to learn how to use wisdom to encourage one another. And then we see that as they go into this, she invites Haman and the king to a banquet, and they go in to have a banquet, and the king says, you know, what do you want? What do you want? Up to half of my kingdom. And she says, come to my banquet again tomorrow. And so Haman is really happy because he's been invited. Only he and the king got invited to the queen's banquet. So he goes back home and as he's leaving, Mordecai is standing out there. And guess what Mordecai does or doesn't do? He doesn't bow down to Haman, and that just burns him up. And so Haman goes back home, and he's telling his wife and his council there, you know, all the great things that's happened, but this Mordecai, I see him, and none of that satisfies me because of this one fellow Mordecai. And in verse 13 of chapter 5, it says, yet all of this does not satisfy me. Every time I see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the gate, then Zeresh his wife and all his friends said to him, have a gallows 50 cubits high made in the morning, ask the king to have Mordecai hanged on it, then go joyfully with the king to the banquet. And the advice pleased Haman, so he had the gallows made. So his wife advised him to build a big gallows so he could have Haman hanged on it, but have Mordecai hanged on it. And he says, yeah, that's a good idea. That's a good plan. So he builds this. If you read on later, he builds this like in his yard or right there at his house. And the gallows, as I understand, it's not like a hanging gallows like you would think about like in the Old West, but it was something that they would maybe crucify somebody on, or a big long pole that they would impale them on and leave their body up there. So that sounds, you know, if you're going to do that to somebody, would you want to do that in your yard, in front of your house or behind your house? I mean, that is the evil that must have been in, and the hatred that must have been in his heart. And so here we see, you know, Mordecai's in a bad situation, right? It appears that, you know, the second man in control of the whole kingdom is building a large pole to have him impaled on it in the morning. But we look at in chapter 6, verses 1 through 3. It says, during that night, the king could not sleep. So he gave an order to bring the book of records, the chronicles, and they were read before the king. It was found written what Mordecai had reported concerning Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs who were doorkeepers, that they had sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. The king said, "What honor or dignity has been bestowed on Mordecai for this?" Then the king's servants who attended him said, "Nothing has been done for him." So if you read about this, it's almost law that if somebody does something like this for the king and the Persians, they had to be honored. Something had to be done for them. Now, do you think it was just coincidence that the king can't sleep that night? Or do you think that the power of God was keeping him up? Or do you think it was just coincidence when they started reading from the book? Because I'm going to guess that there have been a lot of business transacted there in the king's palace. He just happens to flip over to the page where it talks about how Mordecai had, you know, unveiled the plot to kill him. And he says, you know, what did we do for Mordecai? It's all, we didn't do anything for him. And so I think that we can see God working in that. And also I think we can see that God influenced that situation, and he allowed that to be the king's choice, didn't he? You know, God just put him in the situation, and the king, you know, so we see the power of God isn't just like, you know, striking down, you know, men, or we talk about how the Israelites were in battle and he would, you know, send hailstones down on the enemy or cause them just to all die in the middle of the night. We see his power also is the way he influences men, and they don't even know they're being influenced. Do you think the king knew he was being influenced by God? No, he had no idea. We see that he was. And so, to save some time, the next morning Haman comes in and he's getting ready to ask the king permission to impale Mordecai there at his house. And so he comes in, he's standing in the courtyard, and the king motions him in with his scepter. And the king says, What should you do for somebody that you want to honor? And so Haman gives all these things, thinking that it's about him. You know, he wants him led around town with his robe on his horse and proclaiming in front of him that, you know, this is the man that the king wishes to honor. And he tells Haman, he says, "Yeah, I like your plan. That's a great plan. Go and do all this for Mordecai." Now, how do you think that made Haman feel? I mean, that, you know, I want Mordecai, you know, killed. And now the king is honoring him. So now he has to go and parade him through the street, and talks about how whenever Haman went home, he put something over his head because he was so ashamed and he was afraid. And if you read down there at the end of the verse, he goes back and starts talking to his wife and to his wise men. We see that there in verse 13 of chapter 6, it says, Haman recounted to Zeresh, his wife, and all his friends everything that had happened to him. Then his wise men and Zeresh, his wife, said to him, "If Mordecai, before whom you have begun to fall, is of Jewish origin, you will not overcome him, but will surely fall before him." So now I think even we see those people are starting to see God is protecting Mordecai. And they're starting to see that power of God because they knew. The people, they were the wise men. They had studied the Jewish religion. They knew some of the history of that. And so now they're starting to say, you know, if all these things are happening and you've got this decree you put out to kill the Jews and the king's honoring this guy and you're trying to kill him, it's not looking good for you. And so immediately while he's having that conversation, the eunuchs come and they get him and they take him to the banquet, the next banquet that Esther has prepared for him. And so, in verse 3 of chapter 10, chapter 7, so they're in there in the banquet, and then Queen Esther replied, says, because the king comes in and says, "What is it that you're asking?" It says, the Queen Esther replied, "If I have found favor in your sight, O king, if it pleases the king, let my life be given me as a petition and my people as my request. For we have been sold, I and my people, to be destroyed, to be killed, to be annihilated. Now, if we had only been sold as slaves, men and women, I would have remained silent, for the trouble would not be commensurate with annoyance to the king. Then King Ahasuerus asked Queen Esther, "Who is he and where is he who would presume to do this?" Esther said, "A foe and an enemy is this wicked Haman." Then Haman became terrified before the king and queen. And so finally she reveals what she wants. She says, "My only petition is my life." And she's wanting him to you know, why have, you know, my people have been sold. Now, two people are implicated in this, aren't they? Because Haman had bought them, but who had sold them? The king had sold them to Haman, because remember, he was giving him the talents of silver. And so he immediately realizes, I think, what's happened. So in his anger, he leaves the room. And when he comes back in the room, he finds Haman there laying on the couch, begging for his life from Esther. And we see that he comes in and he makes this statement that, you know, "Will you even assault the queen in the castle in front of me?" I don't know if he thought that he was going to try to kill her or sexually assault her, but I think that was his excuse or his way out to go ahead and remove himself from that guilt. But anyway, he says that, and immediately when he does that, one of the servants says, "You know, Haman has prepared a gallows to impale Mordecai on at his house." And so they cover his head, they take him out, and Haman is hung on his own gallows. And so we see that at the end of this banquet that Esther prepared, you know, God has come in, he's saved and protected Mordecai. But there's still this declaration that all the Jews are supposed to be slaughtered on this day. And so the king comes in and he puts Mordecai in Haman's position and gives him the signet ring. And Mordecai, he makes a new proclamation and signs it with his ring that the Jews can defend themselves and kill all the family and the children of the people that come and attack them. And so we see that when that day comes, the people come, they attack the Jews, but the Jews are victorious. And so we see that the Jews are protected by God. And I think that's the last point that I have for this lesson, is that God protects his people. If you turn over and we look at John, the 10th chapter. Beginning in verse 25. It said, "But Jesus answered them, 'I told you, and you do not believe the works that I do in my Father's name. These testify of me. But you do not believe me because you are not of my sheep. My sheep hear my voice, and I know them, and they follow me. I give eternal life to them, and they will never perish, and no one will snatch them out of my hand. My Father who has given to me is greater than all, and no one is able to snatch them out of the Father's hand. I and the Father are one.'" So here we see that Jesus tells them that nobody is able to snatch his sheep out of his hand. That's us. That's us, as Christians. The same way, the same God that was able to save Mordecai, who was going to be impaled the next day from the second power, the second highest man in the kingdom, protects us. The same God that protected all the Jews there that day that they were going to be attacked by their enemies. That's the same God that protects us. Whenever the king would sign a declaration, it was the type of thing that couldn't be undone. So if he passed a law, they couldn't undo the law. And that's why that whenever Mordecai, he made another law that said they could defend themselves. Um, In this world, whenever we sin and we transgress God's law, that is something that cannot be undone. We have a debt to God. God can't, that debt cannot, that decree can't be undone. But God has another covenant with us. He sent His Son to die on the cross for our sins so that He can pay the price for that debt. The same way that Mordecai, he wrote this other declaration. And so that's a similarity that I wanted to point out. But the lesson, I think the main point of my lesson is that we don't know when God is prepared for us to influence somebody. We need to be living and trying to influence everybody for good and following Christ all the time. Just like David did. Just like Mordecai did. So if there's anybody that wants to become a Christian this evening, or if you've not been living the life and you want to, like a Christian, you want to change, you have something to repent or any other need, come forward as we sing our closing song.